I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
We're here today to celebrate American manufacturing and to showcase the amazing products from all 50 states made in the USA. Remember in the old days, they used to have made in the USA, made in America, but made in the USA. We're going to start doing that again. We're going to put that brand on our product because it means it's the best.
If you were looking for Trump-branded products yesterday as the president kicked off Made in America Week at the White House, you would be sorely disappointed. That's because most of their products are made overseas where there is cheaper labor and fewer regulations. We asked Matea Gold to join us. She's national politics reporter for The Washington Post, where she covers money, influence, and ethics. She and her colleagues investigated Ivanka Trump's clothing and accessory line that is made in factories in Bangladesh, Indonesia, and China, where workers put in long hours and survive largely on subsistence wages. And she joins us from the studios of The Washington Post. And Matea Gold, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, great to be with you.
What was the reaction to the debut of Made in America Week yesterday?
So it was interesting that the White House chose to proceed with the theme they had set out for this week. We actually had unveiled our piece on Friday and ran in Sunday's paper, which was a three-month examination of the production and business practices of Ivanka Trump's brand. And one thing we found was that she exclusively produces her apparel and handbags and shoes in foreign factories in Asia. And the brand's president actually told us that it's just not realistic for them to move production back to the United States in a large-scale fashion. They say there's not trained workers to do this kind of production anymore, and in many cases, the machinery doesn't even exist. So the question hanging over the White House's Made in America push this week is very much how realistic is it to ask companies to do this when the president's the company owned by the president's daughter is saying this is impossible for them.
Now, she owns the company. Does she run it, Matea?
She separated herself from daily management of the company after Trump was elected, but she does, as you mentioned, still own the company. And she does have the ability to veto or okay new licensing deals. And so this very much is still Ivanka Trump's company, even though she's not involved in the day-to-day management.
Now, most of our clothes, if we look at the labels, most of our clothes are made overseas. Is there something unique or different about how Ivanka has her clothes made?
No, her brand is very much in line with the practices of other U.S. apparel companies in that they do production overseas. In fact, 97% of our clothes and shoes are made overseas now. What we found that really set the brand apart was that they lag behind many other companies in the industry when it comes to oversight of their foreign production. So in the last 20 years, since I think American consumers have really had a growing awareness about the exploitation of foreign workers, apparel companies have increasingly tried to bring some transparency into their production. There's attempts to independently audit factories overseas. A lot of companies disclose where their goods are made, even the name and addresses of the factories. These are measures that the Ivanka Trump brand has yet to take, and they say they're working to bring in a nonprofit group now to help them with independent oversight.
You described it as a more hands-off approach. Does that mean that she does not know what happens inside these factories?
Well, so the brand's approach to this to date has been to have a code of conduct that it asks its suppliers, which license its name, to comply with. And so experts in the field told us it's very hard to have assurances that these rules are all being followed, even if you're working with the best in the field, because you don't have your own independent window into what's going on in these factories. And so because conditions do vary so dramatically often from factory to factory and from country to country, many supply chain experts encourage companies to try to do their own independent oversight of production.
A number of workers who make the products that Ivanka Trump sells are interviewed in this piece. What do they tell you about what it's like to work at one of these factories?
So I think it's important to keep in mind that the experience of the workers in these factories is no different than working for the Ivanka Trump brand than for many other brands. Right. In fact, many of these factories produce goods for many American labels. And, you know, what we found was a similar story in many different countries. We spoke to workers in Indonesia and China, as well as workers in Bangladesh. And workers told us that they really often work for subsistence wages, that they experience intense pressure often from supervisors to meet these production quotas. In Indonesia, we spoke to many women who cannot afford to keep their children with them, and so their children live in their home villages, often hours away, and they see them once a week, maybe even once a month. This is a reality for low-wage workers in many of these factories, and you know there are ways that companies seek to make sure that there are ample protections for these workers while also acknowledging they're not going to be paid the same wage as American workers. But there's many ways that labor groups are pushing companies to try to bring a little more of a window into what's going on in their production.
Are we talking about largely women in these low-wage jobs?
The garment industry internationally is predominantly made up of women, and in some countries such as Indonesia, it's almost exclusively women. And this was another theme that we explored in our story because Ivanka Trump really developed the woman who work theme at her brand. That's sort of the driving motto of her company, and she wrote in a book that came out this spring that her life's mission is to try to work on improving the conversation around women and work. And so this raised questions about whether that was a philosophy she brought throughout her production process. And it's something the president of the brand told us that they really seek to extend throughout their supply chain now.
And apparently her labels on the Women Who Work brand is act purposefully, I'm quoting from your piece, invest in each other. Is that for the women who wear the clothing or for the women who make it?
Well, the marketing of Women Who Work, I think, has been a very effective branding campaign for the clothes. I think they did hit on a theme that resonated with a lot of young, you know, middle-income, upper-middle-class women who seek to buy mid-level fashion, who are juggling work and family. Ivanka Trump herself really features predominantly in this branding. She has a very active Instagram feed in which she posts pictures of herself and her family. So it seems that the focus of the motto is really developed around targeting American consumers, but it did raise questions for us about whether that was a philosophy that they applied to the actual production of the clothes as well.
How profitable is her clothing and accessory line?
So we don't know because it's a private company and they will not disclose their financial figures, but one of their retail suppliers said that they had revenues about $100 million in the 2016 fiscal year. And the brand president told us that revenues were up last year and are continuing to rise this year. And so one of the things we discovered in our reporting is that, as with anything with the name Trump in it, her brand has become polarized in the political debate, and it appears that many women who are fans of Ivanka Trump are now flocking to buy her clothes, post selfies of themselves wearing them with hashtags such as adorable deplorable, a reference to the deplorable jab that Hillary Clinton made in her campaign. And so it's emerged as sort of a political statement to wear Ivanka Trump clothes, which was not, I think, the intent of Ivanka or the brand when she set off to develop this company.
Just can't buy them at Nordstrom's anymore, right?
Nordstrom's did drop the line, but you can still find her clothes at stores such as Macy's and Lord & Taylor and online as well.
There's this Better Work program. This is an international organization, I guess, working to improve working conditions in some of these factories that you've been talking about. How effective have they been? Are they supported by other American clothing labels, including Ivanka Trump's?
So Better Work is a program that is jointly funded by a body of the UN and also a body of the World Bank. And it has also received nearly $24 million in funding from the U.S. Department of Labor since 2010. And the program really looks to go into countries and help factories improve their workplace conditions and also work with governments to develop best practices as an effort to sort of lift the bar for workers around the world. So there's sort of a more even playing field of not only labor rules, but compliance as well. And executives at the Ivanka Trump brand noted that several of their factories participate in this program. One thing that we discovered in our reporting is that the Trump administration has proposed slashing the money that the U.S. gives to the Better Work program through the Department of Labor.
In fact, talk a bit about that. As you wrote in the piece I read this morning, is that the administration is planning cutting something like 80% of the money for this government office in the Labor Department, as you just mentioned, that what monitors the treatment of foreign workers? How does it work, and why is this significant?
So this is a small government office in the Department of Labor that has a couple of purposes. It's really it's aimed at ensuring that the labor regulations and trade agreements are complied with, and it also seeks to prevent the exploitation of foreign workers. And American companies like this program because they say, you know, if foreign workers are exploited, it actually makes it harder for American workers to compete on an even playing field. So American companies, particularly in the apparel and food industries, are very supportive of this program, and they've sent letters to Congress urging them to restore the nearly 80% in funding cuts that the White House is seeking for this office. Conservatives have been opposed to the program, one, because it supports programs on the ground that encourages some labor unions and provides support for labor unions, and also out of a sense that they don't believe the Department of Labor should be involved in international grant giving, and they question the effectiveness of the grants. But the one thing that program does is it produces this very comprehensive, detailed report about the use of forced or child labor in industry sectors around the world. And American companies rely on this report to give them some guidance about their own supply chains, and really it's to serve as sort of a warning light if there's an area in which they need to be careful with.
Do you think the future for this office is uncertain, or this pushback, do you think this will restore at least some of the money?
Well, it is up in the air right now. There have been attempts to cut the funding in past years, and traditionally the Senate, with the support of the Obama White House, has restored funding that was cut on the House side. Because the White House is pushing for these cuts, it's unclear what's going to happen when this moves to the Senate.
Any way to know whether consumers, especially people that love Ivanka Trump's brand of shoes and handbags and clothing, whether this is a big issue to them?
So the customers that we spoke with, I think, had the reaction that you'd have of any consumer buying any product in the United States, which is, look, I'd love to buy products that are made in the United States, but it's really hard to find them, and it's often more expensive than foreign-made products. And that's just a reality right now of our apparel industry. There are companies making goods in the United States, often at affordable prices, but they're harder to find. It takes a lot of research and digging if you're a consumer, and people have busy lives, and they, you know, want to quickly buy accessible fast fashion.
We're going to end on that note. Matea Gold, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. National politics reporter for The Washington Post, where she covers money, influence, and ethics. And we were talking about the Made in America Week announced at the White House yesterday. Coming up, Caesar's Last Breath and why we should care. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, there's nothing more basic, more essential, and more life-giving than breathing. It's something we mostly do without a second thought. Sam Keen writes in his new book, Caesar's Last Breath, that we inhale the history of the world through invisible gases with every breath we take. He takes readers on a tour of the gases that make up our atmosphere and our bodies, and the quirky, brilliant, and sometimes misbehaving scientists who define their properties. The book is also filled with fascinating nuggets and asides. Who knew that Albert Einstein was obsessed with building a better and safer refrigerator? Or that Thomas Beddoes, whom Keane described as the strangest man in English science, thought that living in a cattle shed, something he called cowhouse therapy, would cure consumption? Well, it didn't. Or that a pig named Pig 311 survived the nuclear test at Bikini and was used for propaganda purposes to sell the safety of nuclear weapons. Well, Sam Keane joins us once again, and he writes about science, and he's sitting across from me here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. So explain to us our most basic thing that we do to keep ourselves alive, which is breathing. What happens when we breathe?
Well, basically, we expand our lungs, lowers the pressure inside our chest, and gases from the outside come into our lungs. Most of them just go right back out because most of it's nitrogen. We don't really use nitrogen. Or I should say most of it comes into us and doesn't really do anything. But the oxygen is really what we're trying to breathe in. That's the important thing that we need inside of us. But even though nitrogen and oxygen make up over 99% of the air, there's a whole bunch of other gases in the air that really give the air its overtones, its finish. They're really what make the air kind of special and interesting in a lot of ways. So the book kind of marches us through all of the gases we breathe and tells kind of an interesting, unusual, cool story about each one of them.
Indeed, and some interesting, cool, and unusual people as well.
Yeah.
You talk about sextillion gas molecules. How many zeros in sextillion?
There should be, I think, 21 zeros after that. It's a very, very large number of molecules that we breathe every single time we take a breath. It's almost an unfathomable number.
It is.
Like our brains can't quite wrap our heads around what it actually is.
Well, let me take the title of your book, Caesar's Last Breath. Your basic thesis is that we are breathing in Caesar's exhale.
Yeah, it's kind of a classic problem or exercise in chemistry and physics classes. The question is, are we inhaling right now with this breath any molecules that Caesar breathed when he died, was assassinated in 44 BC? And when you look at the huge, huge number of molecules we breathe, the 25 sextillion or so, the odds are very, very good that we are breathing in a molecule that he exhaled every single time we breathe, despite the fact it happened over 2,000 years ago,
right.
Despite how big and enormous the atmosphere is. There are just so many molecules that statistically you're almost certainly breathing one in. And it's this really interesting connection to an event in the past that you wouldn't really think about, but that does touch your life on a daily basis many times.
Obviously, Caesar, much more famous than most people that lived on Earth,
uh-huh.
But can we say that we're also breathing everyone who ever lived? Some of their molecules.
Yeah,
that we're
exactly.
Inhaling?
You can say that about any single person who ever lived. You're inhaling the exact same air that they did in a lot of cases, and sometimes it's really kind of thrilling and touching to think about. You know, any one of your heroes in history, like Confucius, Amelia Earhart, whoever you want, you're breathing in the same air they are. Unfortunately, it gets a little uncomfortable sometimes because the villains in history, you're breathing in the same
True.
Air they did too. So it kind of cuts both ways. But this breathing is really one thing that unites all of us in history, enemies, friends, everyone.
I get the feeling from your book that you want to make sure that the gases get the same attention and credit that liquids and solids get.
Right.
True, not
yeah,
true?
It's kind of a basic fact.
Because we can't see it, right?
Yeah. There's an old joke about two fish who are swimming around, and one of them says to the other, you know, how's the water today? And the other one says, what's water? And you know, it's not a very good joke, but human beings are kind of in the same relationship with air in that it's ubiquitous, it's omnipresent, but it's invisible, so we really don't notice it. And in fact, for thousands and thousands of years, up until the 1600s, people really didn't know the air existed. They weren't really aware of it until people finally said, oh, you know, there is this material substance around us. It's made up of matter. It can do work. It is like a substance, even though we're not aware of it.
Well, let's go back to the very, very beginning. You do this in your book as well. I guess the fiery start of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
What do we need to know about that in terms of understanding these molecules, these gases?
Well, Earth has actually had many distinct atmospheres in its history. One that was very early was hydrogen, helium, kind of blew off. But then we've accumulated other atmospheres over time. And the first real substantial atmosphere we had was very nasty, all these hot, horrible gases that if you could go into a time machine and go back and, you know, step outside, take a deep breath, your lungs would just start searing and burning inside
of you. You'd
die. You would die pretty quickly, not only because there was no oxygen around, but these gases were actively dangerous to life. So the fact that the atmosphere has changed over time is very important because we wouldn't have life. We wouldn't have life as we know it, definitely, without it. And in fact, something like oxygen, we think about it as vital for life today, but life arose well before oxygen ever existed on our planet. So, and in fact, oxygen was a poison for the vast majority of life that existed on the planet. And there were events in the past called the oxygen catastrophe, where oxygen just basically wiped out most life that existed because it was a deadly poison. So it goes to show you how the perspective really changes over time. Something we think about as vital now used to be deadly.
So how did oxygen become benign or life-giving?
We basically, some of our ancestors got lucky. They figured out how to harness oxygen. And I kind of compare it to the idea of plutonium. If you have a nuclear power plant, you have plutonium in there. Plutonium is very useful. It can do some useful work, but you have to keep it contained. You can't let the plutonium just sort of float free around the room. You have to keep it contained. And our cells do a lot the same thing with oxygen. They keep it contained. They don't let it kind of roam around because it was very reactive. It would start destroying things otherwise. So in a sense, they basically got lucky. And then once they learned how to harness it, then you could have more advanced life forms.
But isn't that evolution at work? Human evolution?
Oh, yeah. It's totally evolution.
I mean, adapting to the environment.
It started with microbes way back then. Right. And then you start to see it move forward in time. But yeah, it's completely evolution.
Obviously, the very beginning of the Earth, you write about asteroid impacts, how important they were, also volcanic eruptions, and talking about the volcano of Mount St. Helens.
Mm-hmm.
You say that's the greatest geology lesson in American history. How so?
Because
what was that, about 20, 25 years ago?
It was early 80s, so getting close to 30 years ago
now.
It was the greatest geology lesson because there have obviously been very large volcanic eruptions in the history of North America before, but that was the first really big one where we had modern equipment, we had a lot of people around to monitor it, and there was a lot of intense media focus because they knew it was coming for a while ahead of time. And it was really a lesson in watching, you know, gases build up underground and then come exploding out of this volcano.
There was a guy, not the Harry Truman, but
a different Harry Truman,
living very close to Mount St. Helens, and he says, "I ain't leaving."
He was not going to leave.
I'm not doing this.
He had been kind of on the run from the law early in his life. He was a rum runner for a while during Prohibition, ended up taking refuge there, falling in love with the place, opening a campground, lived there with his wife for a very long time, very much in love. She ended up dying, unfortunately. And when Mount St. Helens, the eruption warning started, he said, "I am not leaving. This is where I lived this life with my wife. I am staying here." He refused all efforts to evacuate him, and he became kind of a media celebrity, very colorful. He would swear all the time, you know, drink whiskey. He's like exactly what you wanted to envision in this situation, living in this cabin. Refused to leave and thought that the threats of the eruption were overblown. Well, it turned out they weren't. And in fact, he ended up dying in the eruption, probably the first person, one of the first people to die. And what happened to his body, we don't know exactly, but it's very likely that the hot gases sort of broke down all the molecules in his body and sent his body actually up into the air, into the atmosphere. So just like with Caesar's last breath, there are probably little molecules of him floating around in the atmosphere.
So he became a gas?
Basically, yeah. You see this in other eruptions in history, too, where you see even like the brains inside people's head, it gets so hot so quickly that the brains liquefy and then turn into a gas. So that's almost certainly what happened to him. Maybe not all of him, but a large percentage of him, especially the water molecules, would have gone up and become a gas and were floating around in the atmosphere.
In an instant, probably, once very quickly, heat and whatever hit him.
Yeah, there's so much energy in a volcano coming down. It's just overwhelming and would immediately do that to him.
Talking with Sam Keen in this hour of Radio Times, talking about a man named Harry Truman, not the president of the United States, but he was essentially incinerated when he decided not
vaporized.
To leave Mount St. Helens, one of the many people in Sam Keen's new book called Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. As much as your book is about these molecules, these gases, it's also in many ways about the people who were involved in trying to figure all of this stuff out. And it seems that accidents and perhaps crazy ideas plays a very important role when it comes to these kinds of discoveries. True? Not true?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a general theme in science, is you see a lot of, you know, accidental, serendipitous discoveries. And what it really is people knowing how to take advantage of those discoveries. So that's what really fascinates me about the science. I like the actual science, you know, studying the things, but it's the people and the stories behind them, the heroes, the villains, the conflicts, the things like that are really what kind of drive the book.
Well, let's talk a little bit about oxygen. And there was a guy named Priestley and a guy named Lavoisier seemed almost in competition to try to understand what oxygen was all about.
Yeah, there's a few people in history who are kind of traditionally given credit for discovering oxygen. Priestley and Lavoisier are a few of them. And Priestley was an Englishman. Lavoisier was French. And Priestley was a little naive in that he kind of talked about his experiments with Lavoisier without realizing that Lavoisier might try to horn in on them a little bit and take credit. And I talk in the book a bit about kind of the curse of oxygen, in that all of the people who ended up discovering it came to very bad ends.
They did.
Yeah. One man that we didn't talk about, Carl Scheele, eventually he accidentally poisoned himself. He died that way. Joseph Priestley instigated a riot, got burned in effigy. His house got destroyed. He got run off, actually, to the United States. He was friends with Benjamin Franklin, ended up kind of in the area, actually, in the Philadelphia area outside it, and resettled here. And then Lavoisier, during the French Revolution, actually got beheaded. They marched him onto a stage and chopped his head off with a guillotine. So oxygen was kind of a cursed substance for these people.
But Lavoisier had interesting things he used. I mean, obviously was studying breathing, but he mummified some of his experimenters with him?
Yeah, his poor assistant had to go through lot of different things.
I guess that you didn't sign a release form.
No, there were no human subject boards back then. Basically what he did is he wanted to know what we were breathing in, what we were breathing out, and how it changed inside of us. And he didn't want the complicating factor of our bodies being exposed. So what he did is he wrapped his assistant completely in a substance that was covered with kind of a latex-like substance so that nothing else would go in or out, basically glued a tube to his lips and let him breathe in and breathe out for a few hours. And then he would do things like have him eat a big meal. How did that affect breathing? Or do some exercise. How did that affect breathing? Kind of these crude experiments, but they were the first real attempts to get at what happens when we breathe, what changes are going on inside the body. And even though Lavoisier probably didn't discover oxygen on his own, he was really the one who helped us understand what oxygen is, what it's doing. So he does deserve a lot of credit for his work, even if he probably wasn't the discoverer of oxygen.
And apparently this person who was the subject of this experiment lost weight. And you asked, so where does weight go when we lose it, right?
Right. It's kind of, you never really think about
I never thought about
that
before.
Where does lost weight go? But a lot of it actually does get turned into gases. And then we exhale it and we breathe it out. So that is kind of the answer to the question. Where does it go? A lot of it ends up turning into gases and we exhale it.
Let's talk about nitrogen. And again, some fascinating people involved in this discovery. Fritz Haber being one, Carl Bosch being the other.
Yeah. Fritz Haber is the one that I think is just such a fascinating subject. He's kind of this Faustian figure in that he was the one who figured out how to take the nitrogen in the air and turn it into a useful substance, into ammonia, which we can then use in fertilizers. And basically half the people on Earth would not exist today without Fritz Haber's process because it is so important in fertilizing, so basic. And Carl Bosch was the one who really figured out how to take that process, turn it into an industrial process, and kind of spread it around the world. Both men, however, ended up getting indicted or accused, at least, of being international war criminals for work they did during World War I. Mm-hmm. Bosch, who was a little spurious, he probably shouldn't have been accused, but Haber was the one who really invented modern gas warfare, figured out what chemicals to use, how to deploy them, and a lot of people in the community, the scientific community, hated him for decades and decades after that because he was really the one who figured out how to turn chemistry toward this really wicked, cruel end. So his legacy is very contradictory.
And the idea, I guess, that fertilizer could lead to poison gas.
Yeah, you can use the same products that you put into fertilizer to make things like explosives. So you see that sometimes when people build crude homemade bombs, they end up buying a lot of fertilizer and using it. And part of the reason Haber was motivated to do this was not just fertilizer, but to make explosives for the German army.
Well, it's interesting because you also write about Alfred Nobel, who we know for the Nobel Prizes,
right.
But he was a dynamite maker.
Yeah, that's how he made his fortune, basically, was inventing, selling, spreading dynamite. And he was content, basically, to do this, to kind of work on this, expand his business around the world, until he sort of famously read his own obituary. Basically, what happened was his brother had died. They confused him, and a French newspaper ran his obituary, ripped him apart, called him the Merchant of Death. And he had this moment where he said, this is going to be my legacy. I can't do this. So he decided to set up the Nobel Prize Foundation. And the money that goes to those prizes today basically was founded on a dynamite fortune and only came about because this man was trying to change his legacy, basically.
The accidents of science,
yeah.
I guess. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Sam Keen about his new book. It's called Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. He's written a number of other books that are science-related, including The Disappearing Spoon, The Violinist's Thumb, The Tale of Dueling Neurosurgeons. And he joins us this portion of Radio Times to talk about how our breath really connects us to our ancestors and to the world and to history. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Many more molecules to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Sam Keen about Caesar's Last Breath, about the gases that we breathe in and breathe out. I should add he's speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Franklin Institute here in Philadelphia. And if you want to send us a text, 267-405-2006. Well, let's talk about someone else that you write about in this book, someone you describe as a medical gadfly, a guy named Thomas Beddoes. What do we need to know about him?
So he was an English scientist working right around 1800 who decided that gases were going to cure all of these different diseases. It was a time when people were discovering new gases. There's a lot of hype about them, and he decided they were going to be the cure-all for everything. So, you know, all the diseases of the day, especially consumption, tuberculosis, he thought that these gases were going to treat them. So he set up this clinic in Bristol in England to treat people with different gases. And most famously, he ended up treating them with nitrous oxide, where they would make it in these green silk bags and they would inhale it. And he thought it would help cure them of whatever diseases they have. Well, we know nitrous
didn't
better
work.
As laughing gas
yes.
nowadays. So the clinic ended up being kind of this strange thing where by day you'd have all these people coming in who were trying to get treatment for various ailments. But then one of the assistants there, a famous chemist named Humphrey Davy, was very interested in the psychological manifestations of this gas. So he would invite all his friends over at night and then they would huff the gases and basically sit around and get high on these gases all night, but then explore it. It was kind of a way to expand their consciousness in a lot of ways.
But obviously it didn't work.
It didn't
you
work.
You can't cure consumption this
You
way.
Cannot cure those diseases with it. But it's interesting because he had poets like Samuel Taylor Coleridge coming around who were very interested in how it would expand their mind and kind of influence their art. And also, it seems kind of unbelievable nowadays, but there was a throwaway line in this book that Humphrey Davy wrote where he wrote something about how you could imagine that this might be an advantage in surgical procedures because Humphrey Davy was a clumsy guy, you know, he kept hitting his thumb or he would get these cuts. But he noticed that whenever he would take nitrous, it didn't hurt suddenly. Right. And for some reason, the medical community just couldn't quite make the next step of, oh, maybe we could actually use this in surgery. But this is the first real hint that something like anesthesia might come about and really revolutionize modern medicine. But there's just one throwaway line.
And truly just a throwaway line.
Yeah, where he mentioned it once in a 600-page book. That was the only mention of it and then moved on quickly to something else. So
when you look back at how human beings tried to understand air, was it there was good air and bad air? I mean, before we began to have a much more complex understanding, was it sort of good, evil, good, bad?
Yeah, you see that in the theory of bad air causing diseases. Malaria, for instance, literally means bad air because they thought that air is really what caused these different diseases. That was a very popular, long-standing theory before they realized that microbes, viruses, bacteria, things like that exist. But yeah, you had a definite split at the time with bad air causing diseases. And then you could say, oh, well, you know, logically then right. maybe good air could cure diseases. So it was kind of the flip side to that theory that Beddoes was exploring.
In fact, you say in Greek, the word for chaos.
Yeah, the word gas is derived from the word for chaos, which on a molecular level really makes a lot of sense because gases are these, you know, molecules just running around, knocking into each other. So in a lot of ways, it's a very appropriate etymology for it.
Well, let me get some callers to join the conversation. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Josie from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Josie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, my question is this. Are we more likely to be affected by someone who picking in the air of someone who's close to us, we have frequent contact with? And how does DNA, how is DNA included in this scenario?
Well, Josie, I appreciate the call. And actually, we have a tweet. If Caesar's molecules are floating around and one gets in my mouth before I take a swab, will it show with my DNA test? So some interest in DNA. Related. Go ahead,
okay.
Sam.
So yeah, you are breathing in the air of people who are around you more frequently just because they are closer and you're going to be inhaling some of those same molecules. Eventually, over the long term, they will get spread out around the world. But in the short term, you are going to breathe in these molecules. As for DNA, it's not going to come into play because most of the molecules, especially nitrogen, the main component, are very, very small molecules, much smaller than DNA. So they're not going to be like dragging the DNA out of you and kind of having it floating around. So Caesar, these other people, the people around you, you're not going to be interacting with their right. DNA. It'll be more just the actual air molecules that were inside their lungs, inside their body, that are then exhaled out.
Which is why if someone has a really bad cold, we tell them not to come to work, right? Otherwise, they could spread it to us.
Yeah, basically what you do right. is you sneeze or something, and these viruses, the bacteria, are very, very small, and they can float around in the air. But that's a little different than someone's actual DNA like,
yes.
coming out.
So. Josie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Well, you can't do a show about gases and molecules without talking about Pujol. he was known as the fartomaniac.
The Fartiste of Paris.
Fartiste of Paris. So go
so
ahead.
Basically,
Sam.
He was active at the Moulin Rouge, very late 1800s in Paris, and he did impressions with flatulence. There's no really delicate way to put it. That's what he did. But he was the most popular artist of the time, higher paid, more popular than anyone. And on some level, it seems kind of like lowbrow humor, but he had a lot of fans. Renoir was a fan. Ravel was a fan. Freud was a fan. The King of the Belgians came
to see him
incognito. He was very, very popular, very good. All these impressions and things he would do. He would do animals. He would sing songs. He would sing the Marseillaise, like the French national anthem, using his rectum, basically. And so in the book, I talk a little bit about, you know, what he was doing anatomically and basically what flatulence is. There's misconceptions about it. Most people think that methane, for instance, is the part that smells. It's not methane and it's other gases, basically how it works. And I included it in the book because it's something that we think about. We maybe don't admit we think about it, but we're curious about it. We want to know about these things. And he was a fun, interesting way to get into that story. And it's a memorable story.
Well, indeed it is. And you write that the average adult releases gas 3 pints of gas each day. Did I read that right?
Yeah, we release a lot of gas, a little more than we would think or want to be comfortable with. But you know,
or be willing to admit to,
or willing to admit to, right? But you know, it's something we all do, and it's a basic thing, a basic part of our biology, our physiology. So,
well, speaking of that, you also say there's how do I put this? That we speak from our mouth and not from our
The derriere,
right. And there's a reason for that. I mean, there's a tube that connects, right?
There's a tube that connects them, yeah. So, I mean, if you look at evolution, if you were to run it again, there's no reason why it couldn't have been flipped around and we could have spoke from the other end. It didn't work out that way. But in some ways, you know, the design we have is not a good design because we take in food and water right next to our lungs. You can get those mixed up. You can swallow things. So it's a dangerous setup in some ways. Could have been safer, possibly, if things had gone the other way around.
Sam Keen, his book is Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. And if you can stomach that, you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We're going to make a giant leap to Operation Crossroads. This was back in 1946, an experiment to drop a bomb on something like 90 ships in the in the Pacific. What was the thinking behind this?
Basically, they just wanted to know what would happen. It was kind of a crude experiment where it was right after World War II. They were interested to know how warfare was going to change, what nuclear bombs were capable of, what they were going to do. So they got a bunch of old ships, decommissioned ships. Some of them were Japanese ships or German ships. Put them in a harbor down in the South Seas and just dropped a nuclear bomb to see how they would be affected. They also had a lot of animals on the ships, things like goats, rats, pigs. They dressed them up in uniforms.
Let me stop you there because you write that. Why? And were there certain animals that wore uniforms and others that did not?
Yeah, I think the bigger animals are the ones that they would wear, that would didn't like have little rat uniforms that they were putting on. They were human-sized uniforms that they would put on pigs and things.
Why?
Well, they wanted to know if their sailors got exposed to a nuclear bomb, what would happen to them? Would it burn away all the clothing? Would the clothing offer some protection? What exactly was going to happen? They would also cut, like the goats, especially their hair, into human lengths to see if that would protect them. And just basically to see what would happen to soldiers if they got exposed to weapons like this.
And a pig survived, Pig 311.
Yeah,
survived.
Famously. He was called Pig 311 because he had a tag on his ear with that number in it. He was locked into the head, into the toilet of a Japanese destroyer. And no one really knows what happens because no one was around, but the destroyer got basically wrecked by the explosion, probably by the waves or something knocking into it, started to break, started to sink. The pig apparently got out of the bathroom somehow, even though it was locked in there, got into the water and started swimming around. And they found him, I think it was a day later, swimming around the lagoon. And he became kind of a celebrity pig because he was one of the few large animals to survive, and one of the only animals in the near the the epicenter basically to survive. And at first they thought the pig was going to die. You know, his blood cells weren't looking good, things like that. It looked very weak, but it pulled through, and it ended up going to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and was put on display there. Life magazine did a big spread about Pig 311. So he became like this little celebrity.
But you also say used for propaganda purposes, basically to say, you know, nuclear weapons maybe not so dangerous after all.
Yeah, when we think back on like the 1950s, the classic picture we have is like children diving under the desk and covering up. But there was kind of this interlude there where they were trying to emphasize the idea that, no, these weapons aren't that bad. They're not so terrible. And you start to see people kind of, you know, make fun of them or have sport with them. There's a picture in the book of someone cutting basically an angel food cake that's in the shape of a mushroom cloud, and everyone's kind of laughing about this whole thing. So there was kind of this weird interlude era where they were trying to say that these bombs weren't that bad. And Pig 311 was part of the propaganda because the thought was, you know, if a pig can survive it, how bad can it really be?
Wow. This is a fascinating story about Albert Einstein, and we, you know, we credit him with all sorts of things, but who knew that he was really interested in creating a better and safer refrigerator?
He was, yeah. It's kind of this odd footnote to his life history, but what happened basically was he read a story in the newspaper one day about a family in Berlin that died. Some toxic gases leaked out of their refrigerator because the refrigerants then were usually toxic gases. Right. And he was so affected by this, he called up a friend of his named Leo Szilard, and he said, you know, there has to be a better way. We have to invent a better refrigerator. So he and Szilard did that. They set out to invent a better, safer refrigerator. And in fact, they invented three different types of refrigerators and tried to get them to market. It failed for various reasons, but he spent a lot of time working on these refrigerators, which is not something you think about Albert Einstein doing, like working on home appliances and things. But he did spend a fair amount of time during this era working on these.
And did I read that they ran without electricity?
One of the refrigerators he invented did work without electricity. The natural gas was what powered it, but it used several different gases as coolants, as refrigerants. And yeah, it had no motor, so it was completely silent, no electricity. And you see them every now and then, so like in you know, an RV or something, you can get a refrigerator like this. But the vast majority of fridges nowadays do not follow the Einstein model.
No, they don't. Something to think about. Let me get Scott from Pennsylvania to join us. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, yeah. I've heard that certain natural environments, such as like maybe the pine forests out in western United States, have qualities in the air that increase one's sense of physical well-being. And I've wondered if that's been documented and if we know.
Whoops, I think we lost Scott. Do you want to add to that, Sam?
Sure. Yeah, when you get out into, you know, just sort of nature areas, you're probably going to be breathing air with your pollutants in it. It's going to be cleaner air. It's going to be a little more refreshing in that way. So, yeah, definitely if you're breathing that air in, it probably is going to, you know, feel better. You might well feel better. So, yeah, there are subtle differences in the air between places that could affect your well-being.
We're almost out of time here, but very briefly, do you think there are ways to deal with the CO2 crisis that we're dealing with in 20 seconds or less? I'm sorry about that.
It's going to be difficult. I talk in the book about some different solutions, things like, you know, geoengineering, things we can do to try to prevent this buildup. It's a very difficult problem because it gets into ideas about cutting back, about fairness between the first world and the other parts of the world. So it's a fraught issue that I discuss a little bit more in the book.
Well, Sam Keen, thank you for joining us once again on Radio Times. And the book is called Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secret of the Air Around Us. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Adam Stanishevsky, the engineer for our show, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aronson, Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. We could not resist this. We are closing things out with Tom Lehrer, 1959 song, The Elements.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium, and helium, and hafnium, and erbium, and phosphorus, and francium, and fluorine, and terbium, and manganese, and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium, and scandium, and cerium, and cesium, and lead, praseodymium, and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium, and calcium, and chromium, and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.